Well, good evening and welcome back to the Journey Home program. I'm your host, John Mark Grodi, and once again, we have this great privilege here on EWTN to share a story. We're hearing from Charles Johnston tonight. He's a former Presbyterian, although, you know, as always, lower third there, it's hard to know what to put on there. Presbyterian, non-denominational, you mentioned generic Christian.
Yeah.
We'll get into all the nuances of that, but thanks for joining me tonight.
It's a pleasure being here. Thank
Charlie.
You.
Charlie, yeah, it's great to be here with you. So I enjoy this opportunity so much. We were talking beforehand about the weirdness of Catholicism and the odd specificity that shows up in people's stories. You know, we there are those moments that we realize that we're not the author of these stories.
Right.
You know, we're discovering them, living them with God. He's writing them, and there's so many
interesting
details.
Sometimes you're just along for the ride.
Exactly. Awesome. Well, thanks for being here tonight.
Thank you.
I'll step way back. Where would you say your spiritual journey begins with your family?
I guess I would say it begins, you know, I was born in New York City and grew up in New Jersey, so it's a very Catholic part of the country.
Sure.
And my parents was kind of a mixed marriage, so my mother's Irish Catholic, my father was Scottish Presbyterian. So, but there was never any kind of like strife, you know, in the family. It was always kind of very chill, you know,
yeah.
growing up. But we mostly went to First Presbyterian Church in Hackensack, New Jersey, and that's the way I grew up. I grew up going to Sunday services there mostly, but a lot of times we'd go to Mass too, you know, just occasionally. And I actually went to Catholic school. So I went to Our Lady Queen of Peace in Maywood, New Jersey, and we would go to Mass. It felt like, it's 30 years ago, so
yeah.
It felt like it was everyday Mass, but it might have been weekly. I don't know.
Yeah.
I was a kid. But the only thing I was not, have to be involved in was the sacramental prep. So everything else, I went to the religious education classes, I went to Mass with everyone. And so I had a lot of exposure to Catholicism.
And what was your faith like?
Very childlike, I'd say. You know, just, it was very basic. If anything came up that was kind of like one of them, you know, like how many books in the Bible, stuff like that, it would usually just kind of get like, you know, like, well, we got Jesus, and it's Jesus's, you know, it's one of them things where kind of people boil it down to the essence, the major issue, right? It's like Jesus and the Trinity. Everything else isn't important, but there's a lot of important differences.
Yeah.
And so that's the way I grew up going there. And then eventually we started going to like non-denominational churches, and that's even more, you know, generic Christianity. That's like what I said. It's just, you know, the rock concert and then, you know, a sermon. And that's the way I grew up going with that. And, but the whole time, a lot of my friends were Protestant. Mm. And so I felt like I was an apologist for Catholicism. People would say, like, you know, Catholics worship statues or whatever. And I felt like I had to defend it because it wasn't so much Catholics I was defending. It was my mother's side of the family, you know?
Right. Yeah, that's an interesting place to be. And that comes up in these stories a lot, you know, being in these mixed households where there, you know, that there's a difference and you have a subtle sense that the differences are important. But then when you hear, you know, the back and forth, I know that's not true, and I know that's not true. And so you end up in this position, right, of the de facto apologist, because you just want people to get along, right? And you know that.
Yeah. And my grandfather, he was very Catholic, my mother's father, but he also, like, he was always reading his Bible, right? Like, every time I seen him, he's reading the Bible.
Yeah.
And so it kind of cut against the trope that you hear, you know, especially if you read, I would read Jack Chick tracts, because they were like a comic book,
right,
you know?
Right.
And you hear the Catholics Catholics aren't allowed to read the Bible was one that you heard all the time. I'm like, wow, he's a rule breaker. You know, he's reading the Bible, but he's Catholic. Then I heard that, they are allowed, but they just don't. And I knew that wasn't true because I see it happening all the time.
Yeah.
So from generic Christianity, I tried to get more, like I was, you know, you hear all the time, like this is the thing that people say in, you know, in the non-denominational churches, that nobody's 100% right. You know, none of the denominations have it 100% right. So you just go to one that like feels good to you, and you go to one where you like the music or you like the preaching or whatever. And that never really sat right with me because there is absolute truth out there, you know? And to say like, well, this place is 90% right and this place is 85% right, but I like it better than the 90%. It just didn't make sense. So I started reading more into it and looking more into it. And that led me to my first kind of obstacle I came across was, mm-hmm. I looked at my grandfather the one day and I said, how is it that you read the Bible all the time and you're Catholic? You know, like how,
yeah.
You think that reading the Bible would lead you away from Catholicism because, you know, obviously it's not the right church. And he said, yeah, is that right? I said, yeah, and you believe all these things. You read the Bible and you believe all these things Catholics teach. He said, well, let me ask you one question. I said, okay. He said, what's your opinion on John chapter 6? And, you know, now I know what John chapter 6 is, but yeah. At the time I was like, I don't even know what that is. He said, go home, read John chapter 6, and then come back and tell me what you think it means. I said, okay, challenge accepted. You know, yeah. Teenager, like I'm going to show this guy. And I go home and I read it, and first glance, you know, first time through it, it's pretty obvious that Jesus is saying, eat my flesh and drink my blood, right? So then I said, well, I must be missing something. So I start reading all these different commentaries and reading different people's opinions and, you know, well, what's the Protestant take on it? What's the, it couldn't be what this says. Like there has to be another explanation. But as much as I searched, I couldn't really find, and there, you know, different denominations have their opinions on what it means, right. You know, they have, but none of it ever sat right with me.
Almost the lack of curiosity about it sometimes, is it?
Yeah, it's like they get to it and they're like, oh, well, this, it doesn't mean what Catholics think it means.
Right.
But sometimes they don't even offer their own opinion. It's just like, it's not the real presence. Next. On to yeah. John chapter 7. So I just never did come back with an answer. I mean, yeah. You know, me and my grandfather were really close and I had seen him almost every day and I just dropped it.
What was his story? You know, so he was devout and read his Bible. Had your family, that side of the family, been Catholic for a long time?
Oh yeah, my mother's side of the family is, you know, okay. Irish Catholic, so they're
just been all the way
far back to, I guess, St. Patrick, I don't know.
Yeah, but a lot of people have Catholic relatives, but they don't always have Catholic relatives who can share the faith with them, who are reading their Bible, and so
that they were like mass, they, you know, weekly mass goers, and very devout.
Beautiful.
But I don't know how far back. Like I said, sure. St. Patrick probably. I don't know.
But you guys were close, though.
Yeah, we were close, but I never brought it up again.
Sure.
Because I knew, deep down, I knew I had the losing side of the argument. And as a young teenage man, I wasn't going to lose an argument. So I was just like, better to drop it, you know?
Yeah.
And so that, it was like, Trent Horn always says, like a pebble in their shoe. Mm. You know, and that was that pebble in my shoe. I could feel it.
Yeah.
And anytime I thought about, you know, religion or thought about denominations or whatever, the real presence of the Eucharist was always kind of like, you know, kind of gnawed at me. Mm-hmm. But I said it couldn't be right because the Catholic Church, they're the only ones that really, I mean, I didn't even know about Eastern Orthodox at the time, but the Catholic Church is the only ones that really preach this doctrine, but they're wrong on everything else.
Yeah.
So this is what I was thinking is, so if they're wrong on everything else, how can they be right here? They can't be. It's like, you know, an impossibility. So I would ignore it, but it was always, like I said, it was always that thing that just kind of kept coming back to me and coming back to me and coming back to me.
Yeah.
And so that was my early years sure. of faith, you know?
Yeah, the pebble in the shoe analogy is a good one. And it's, I mean, again, it's significant to me that you were close with your grandfather. And even though that you didn't bring it up again with him then, or at least for a long time, or we'll hear the rest of it, but when we can drop those pebbles in, right, in the midst of a relationship where there's obviously love, you right. know, like that's, sometimes those come out in the midst of conflict, you know,
right, yeah.
And then there's an easy excuse to ignore the pebble,
yeah.
you know, or dismiss it. But when it's in the context of, I know this person loves the Lord, and I know they love me, but I got this pebble in my shoe now.
Right. Yeah, if you had to come at me with that, like, hey, you don't even believe in the Eucharist, and
yeah.
I would have just deflected it, never even thought of it again, but it was right. because the way he just kind of planted that seed of, what do you think of John? Just ask me what I thought of it.
Right.
And then what I thought of it, I couldn't really come back with an answer, you know? And like I said, there's John Calvin's take on it, and there's all these different, you know, none of it really, it never sat right with me, like I said.
Sure.
So,
okay.
So that was my teenage years.
Yeah.
And then, you know, fast forward a couple of years, I kind of toyed around with a few different, you know, always within Christianity, but I felt like I was constantly wandering, you know, trying to find my place. You know, I would read about different denominations, and I would kind of visit. I'd go to different church services of different denominations and stuff. And I thought that I was being drawn back to the liturgical, because a Presbyterian service, at that point, I hadn't been to one in years, you know. It's like very ordered. You know, there's an order to it. It isn't like a mega church where it's just, you know, singing, preaching, leave. There was more of an order to it. And so I thought that's what I was craving, was just kind of the order of, you know, a service like that. But you know, now looking back, like you said, you look back on things years later, it was the Eucharist I was really craving. It wasn't just right. a liturgy. It was a liturgy centered around the sacrifice of the Mass. Because I went to a couple different liturgical Protestant churches, and they just felt as, you know, not satisfying as anything else.
Right. We're talking tonight with Charles Johnston, former Presbyterian. A couple things I wanted to ask you there. So during your teenage years and then off into this period, you know, what else was going on in your life? Working, going to school, you know, what was going on in the backdrop of this spiritual searching?
Well, I was being homeschooled.
Okay.
Because my father had a lot of health problems. So I had to get out of school and do homeschooling for a while. And we had to travel around because he had a certain kind of skin cancer that I had to get treated at different, you know, we would go here and go there and kind of took a lot of, put a lot of stress on everyone, really.
Sure.
But yeah, that, and I was working with him. He was a contractor too, so doing construction and stuff.
Yeah.
But it was really trying to find, I never did find satisfaction in any church I went. And I went to church every Sunday. Like, that was one of the things that my parents raised me with, mm-hmm. was we go to church on Sunday. That's what we do as a family, you know? Yeah. And if it wasn't the Presbyterian church in Hackensack, it was, usually if we traveled, that was a funny thing. And even my father, he preferred to go to a Mass if we were traveling, because you know what you're getting, you know?
Yeah.
You're in some other town and you go to, you don't know, you know? Mm. Especially them churches that don't have names, like the ones, you know, the generic name churches, you don't know what you're getting.
Right. The other thing I wanted to ask too is, so you, during this time and the stuff going on in your family, you have this continual intellectual searching, right? Mm-hmm. Then, but again, behind the intellectual searching, what was your relationship with God at this point? I mean, were you praying? Did you have a sense of God?
Yeah, it's kind of like it devolved into solving a problem.
Ah.
You know, and it can happen like that sometimes. And it became, instead of searching for the truth because that'll lead me closer to God, it was more searching for the truth because it was a riddle that I was trying to solve.
Right.
You know, and I did go down that path for a while. And I never lost faith in God. I always believed that God existed. But it became that, like, God became more of a concept than a person. You know, it was this, I was trying to get closer to, well, who had the right formula to solve this, like, mathematical equation, not who has the right formula that's going to get me closer to Jesus, which then gets me to heaven. It wasn't even that at all. Yeah, so.
Which is super relatable. I think we've all experienced that at times.
Yeah.
You know, I love, Father Dubé is one of my favorite writers. He has this little book, Deep Conversion, Deep Prayer. And he makes the point at the beginning of that book that Jesus says, repent and believe the gospel, right? That's in the gospel there, we have this, repent and believe. Not believe,
right.
And then repent,
yeah.
Right? In other words, we don't need to get the, it's not first getting the intellect right, you know, getting all the information, and then I'll change my life. You know, we're all called to be living a good life first,
right.
As we're searching things out. But it's easy for that to kind of fall away as we're puzzling out our riddles, right?
Yeah, and repent is not just say sorry. It's
right.
It's a complete 360.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or 180, actually. 360 would be
yeah,
completely
yeah.
around. But yeah, that's what happened to me, is that it just became, just I wanted to find the truth. And it kind of, it becomes kind of an ego thing. Like, you want to find the truth because then it makes, then you're right, and then it validates your own, like, I found it. You right. know, Eureka,
yeah.
I found the truth.
Yeah.
And I, you know, my journey took so long that got broken down and broken out of me, you know? And so I think that's part of the reason why, I think, looking back on it, that's part of the reason why God had me kind of in the Sinai desert type part of the journey for so long, was that needed to be, you know, needed to be broke out of me, just like yeah. Hebrews, it needed to be broke out of them.
Yeah, oh, makes total sense, because that's the point. If we go through, you know, so here at the Coming Home Network, right, we're helping people become Catholic, they're on that journey, but we recognize that just getting inside the Catholic Church, that's not the point, right? The point
right.
is that it's in the church that we're able to draw close to Christ, the sacraments, all that. We're able to be transformed because we have the fullness. But that's the point, not just arbitrarily, am I in the right camp or not?
Right, right? Yeah. Yeah, that's what it is. It isn't, you're not pledging allegiance to a team to then, that's it. That's the end of the journey. That's the beginning of the journey. You know, when you become yeah. Catholic, that's, and I learned that too, even all the way into RCIA. When I was in RCIA,
yeah.
I was still learning that this isn't just, I get received at the Easter Vigil and I'm done. That's where I start.
Yeah.
You know, and then it just continues on after that.
Yeah. All right. So yeah, what happens next in all of that as the search continues?
So I'm searching, and now kind of, it kind of goes, I wouldn't say by the wayside, but it kind of backseats, you know. I'm in my early 20s. We just moved to Washington, D.C., and I'm really invested in politics, you know, kind of like watching, consuming politics, like, yeah. 24/7.
That's the place to be.
Three different newspapers. Yeah, but I mean, I'm working construction, yeah. but I'm just like a political junkie. I'm not involved.
Right,
I'm
right,
just
right.
a junkie for politics. And I'm reading, I was really a fan of Antonin Scalia and Clarence Thomas. And then, you know, so I would read their opinions and stuff, and I was really a fan of their writing and their way of thinking. And then I find out that Antonin Scalia was Catholic. You know, I come from New York, so if you're Italian, you're Catholic. Just kind of an assumption I make.
Yeah.
But when I found out Clarence Thomas was Catholic too, I was like, oh, that's, you know, that's interesting. So here's these two men that I really like, I looked up to as intellectual, like they were my heroes basically. And both of them are Catholic. And not just like, you know, Catholic, because you meet a lot of people like that throughout the journey, you know.
Yeah.
I get a lot of people come up to me and say, oh, you're a convert. And they're like, oh yeah, I was raised Catholic. Oh, okay, where do you go to Mass? I haven't been to Mass in 40 years.
Yeah.
I'm like, well, come with me. Let's go together.
That's right.
But yeah, the pair of them, like Clarence Thomas goes to Mass every morning before he goes. There's this church right behind the Supreme Court. He goes to Mass every morning. So that kind of shocked me. And then President Bush, the same, so right around the same time frame that I'm discovering that these two guys I really looked up to were Catholic. And I kind of like, when someone was a Catholic, I always thought like, well, they, you know, they haven't looked into it enough. If they looked into it, if they really researched it, they'd know that the, you know, the Protestant Reformation, it freed us from, you know, we were not allowed to read the Bible. You know, the Pope wouldn't let you read the Bible. And it was Martin Luther that gave us the Bible. You know, like, that's what, like, he was like Moses coming down from Sinai, giving us the Bible. So I would always think like, well, how could these two men, like, how do they not know that? Like, I felt like I needed maybe to tell them this, you know, I need to share with them. And then President Bush nominates two new people for the Supreme Court, and both of them's Catholics, Justice Alito and Justice Roberts. And so now I'm like, no, what is going on here? Mm-hmm. How are these men all Catholics? Don't they know the truth? Like, how do they not know the truth? And so that, it got me kind of looking back over things, looking into things, and that basically restarted the engine that had been so, like, laying dormant,
sure.
you know?
Yeah. So you're working in construction at this point. Mm-hmm. Were you married at this point?
No.
That's still to come.
Okay. I was still single. But so I started looking into basically where does the authority lie, you know? So Martin Luther, he has the Protestant Reformation 1517. He breaks away. He frees us, you know, like we were under tyranny and now we're all free. It's kind of like Americanism, but like projected back 500 years, you know? And liberty ring throughout Europe, and Europe was saved. And now if you look at Europe now, you can see that's definitely not the case. But I started looking back into it, and I never did read into history and stuff before when I was thinking about the Eucharist. Like, I read commentaries, kind of modern, even older commentaries, but I never really looked into like the history
right.
of the church.
Well, and you mentioned that you had sort of a caricature, right, from the Jack right. Chick comics and what people had said, you know, about
yeah.
this basic grand history of, oh, there was enslaved and then Martin Luther and now the Christians are freed, right?
Right, right. And there's this strain that runs through that I really got exposed to in the non-denominational churches. There's this strain of kind of pseudo-history that, well, it wasn't really Martin Luther that started, like, there was Christians before that. You know, there was these underground Christians and there was, you know, kind of like the Trail of Blood type
sure.
thing, but they wouldn't call it that, and they never took it that far, but it was kind of that, like, hints of Trail of Blood theory,
yeah.
where all the way back to Jesus, there was this underground true church, and usually it's Constantine. Nobody ever tells you what Constantine done, but Constantine's the boogeyman, and he's usually the one that threw things off the rails. So I started reading into the history of the church to see, like, Where did the church start? You know, Christianity is this thing, you know, there's 2 billion Christians in the world. We all have to kind of funnel back to, you know, a single kind of like a choke point, you know, like, where do we start at? Where do we come from? If it wasn't 1517 of the Reformation, if it wasn't, who was the original Christians? And then I started reading some of the church fathers. And the church fathers, when you read them, when you're a, like, convinced Protestant and you first pick up Clement or Ignatius of Antioch, or Justin Martyr especially, it wouldn't surprise me if someone called them a papist forgery. You know, it's like that's like you read it and you're like, no way. You know, it's like a bishop or a priest from today wrote it and then like planted it somewhere in the Middle East and said, oh, look, we found this writing, you know, because it's so Catholic and it's on the nose Catholic. And you can just like there's no way of saying like they talk about things about like where the bishop is, there the church is. And Ignatius of Antioch uses the word Catholic. And like, what was that, like 150 AD?
Yeah.
And then Justin Martyr, he writes in his first apology, it's like you picked up, you know, when you go to like a Catholic funeral and it's for the non-Catholics there, they give him the order of the mass and tells like, that he wrote that.
Right.
And what was that, like 125?
Right.
And so I'm reading all these different things and it's kind of mind-blowing. You know, it's like one of them things you just don't know what to do with it. You know, you don't know where to... These men that I really look up to, including my grandfather, but like these Supreme Court justices, and now these earliest, like you can't find earlier Christians than Ignatius, Clement, and Justin, and they're obviously Catholic, you know? So then I started saying like, well, where did it, maybe it went off the rails somewhere, maybe it did, but the more you read it, the more the doctrines that they're proposing aren't foreign to a modern Catholic, like those aren't, you know, I mean, it isn't like they said A, B, and C, and then somewhere in the Middle Ages it changed, and then Martin Luther's bringing it back to the original. Yeah. Like, that's all smoke and mirrors. This is the original. So then I was convinced at that point. I said, like, all right, I don't know all what the church teaches. I don't know if I agree with all these, like, because there's like tons of different doctrines that I'm not sure of and all that. I believe in the real presence of the Eucharist because I can't really get around that, you know? And Justin Martyr believed in it, and so did Ignatius and Clement. So that's obviously not a medieval invention of the church. So I believe in the real presence of the Eucharist, and I believe that the church that Christ founded was the Catholic Church that continues to this day. So I have to become Catholic.
You know, that, again, like we talked about earlier with the Eucharist, sometimes what's conspicuous, and we don't want to just pick on Protestants here, this is true in any area of life, and we all fall prey to this in some area or another, but whenever there's an area of truth where we have a conspicuous lack of curiosity about, that's always a place to dig. And like the history is another good example of that, right? There's these very, very minimized caricatures of history, but the curiosity about this question, like what do the earliest Christians really look like and sound like? Because as soon as you, not just as soon as you read them, but even as soon as you kind of allow yourself to be curious about that really legitimate question, that often starts, you know, this journey.
I mean, you know, Newman said to be deep in history is to cease to be Protestant,
right.
You know, and that's, I found that to be true. I found that with several of my friends who have read the fathers of the church to find that same exact. And really, I haven't found anyone yet that honestly, like they're actually honestly, they're not just looking to pick out quotes to throw back as like slings and arrows, but they're actually honestly reading through the fathers. They usually become Catholic. It might take a month, it might take 10 years, but they come over.
Yeah, and again, that honesty is important, and it's something we all have to practice, this intellectual honesty and courage of, like, I want to be challenged by truth, you know?
Well, it takes a lot, to swallow your ego and say, I don't know everything, and there's a really good chance that I'm wrong about a lot of things.
Yeah.
But there's this organization that was founded in, you know, 33 AD, that is right about everything. You know, if the church is real and the church is founded by Christ and the church, you know, the gates of hell won't prevail against it and existed for 2,000 years despite our best efforts as Catholics, you know, then I'm not right about everything, but they're right. You know, and it takes a lot to say that, to admit that you're wrong about so many things.
Yeah, it's hard to admit that they might be right about something, even something, because
then
that might be this trail of breadcrumbs leading to... To the whole. Well, let's take a quick break.
Sure.
And we'll come back and again hear how that plays out. You have this encounter with the early church fathers and it changes things in a big way.
Sure.
So we'll be back in just a couple minutes. Again, I want to remind you, we've got thousands of stories like Charlie's, and you can access them at chnetwork.org/story and elsewhere on the site, all the archives of the Journey Home program. There's a story from every background. You know, every walk of life, every mixed family situation in terms of religion, they're all there. The Lord has done wonderful things in people's lives, and those stories are powerful. So check those out at chnetwork.org. Find one that's like you and share it with your friends and family. We'll be back in just a couple minutes to hear the rest of Charlie's story. See you then. Welcome back to the Journey Home program. We're entering the second half of the hour tonight, and we're spending this time with Charles Johnston, a former Presbyterian, as well as non-denominational, generic Christian, as you've said. And when we left off at the break, you were just telling us about, you know, getting into the early church fathers and being surprised.
Surprised by truth.
Surprised.
As Patrick Madrid would say. I got into the early church fathers and just, I don't know if even surprised or shocked would be the word I would use, because, like I said, they're so obviously Catholic, the early fathers. I mean, you know, a lot of Protestants like to quote, like, St. Augustine, too. He was a bishop. They leave that part out. You know, like, when I first, like, I had to read quotes from St. Augustine all the time when I was reading different things when I was younger. And then I found out, like, hold on a second here. St. Augustine was a bishop who was mentored by St. Ambrose of Milan, who's like one of the doctors of the church. Augustine is too, but that's very Catholic. You know, so yeah, I was shocked by my discoveries.
Yeah. Well, and you told us at the beginning that you'd had that pebble in your shoe that your good devout Catholic grandfather had planted there about the Eucharist, which you hadn't had an answer for.
Yeah.
And when you read the early church fathers, they are unambiguous about the Eucharist.
Yeah.
You know, that it's clear what they believe about it. And so that presents a real difficulty. Like, again, not just why do I not believe this, but why are we not even curious about, could this be true? Could Christ really be giving us to himself in the sacramental way?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, if Christ is present in the Eucharist, that changes everything.
Yeah.
You know? And it wasn't that I felt like the Catholic answer was the right answer, but I couldn't bring myself to say that out loud, even to myself. Like, I was like, no. It was like I was in denial, you know, because if that is true, well, then your only options are become Catholic or kind of live longing for something that you can't have anyway, you know. And there are other denominations that, like, Lutherans believe in, like, a kind of like the real presence, you know, and so do some Anglicans. Depends on, like, who you're talking to, really, when it comes to Anglicans. But yeah, my options at that point when I was remain in denial or admit the truth and become Catholic. And I didn't want to become Catholic.
Yeah.
You know, one of the main things that I found a lot of people are like this too. I was terrified of confession. Because, you know, I'm baptized when I was 3 weeks old in a Presbyterian church. So from everything I read, that's valid, right? So you have to confess everything from baptism until you're received into the church. At this point, I'm like 21 years old. I don't want to tell everyone. Not everyone, but I don't want to tell a priest everything I've done from 3 weeks old to 21 years old. That's a lot. And eventually, by the time I did come into the church, I was 30. So it was even more. I added even more. But it was one of them things that, like, ever have something you dread, and then it happens, and it's like, oh, well, wasn't so bad. I love going to confession now. It's one of them weird, God has a sense of humor kind of things that it actually held me back. Like, even from admitting to myself, this is true. Well, then if this is true, that means I'll have to go to confession to be able to become Catholic. I couldn't go to confession. I just couldn't do it. And now I love going to confession so much that I try to go weekly.
Yeah.
Just because it's you know, so much grace, you receive so much grace, and, like, it's cathartic. You know, it's free therapy. Right. You receive grace. And then the advice that the priest gives you, even if it's just sometimes it's like a quick, like, you know, go forth and sin no more. Sometimes they give you like a good, you know, a couple of minutes of advice. That spiritual advice that you get from the priest is like priceless to me. Yeah. And I love it. So it's God has a sense of humor. Something I was terrified of is now one of my favorite things about the church.
Yeah. Oh, I totally identify with all that. So after encountering the early church fathers, that set you on this new track. So get us back into the narrative there. What happened next after that?
So, like I said, I didn't necessarily agree with, you know, there was the Marian doctrines, the Marian dogmas. There was the infallibility of the Pope. I was like, how could this be so?
Right, right.
But if the early church was Catholic and the early church was founded on, you know, Christ said to Peter, who do you say I am? And he said, you are the Christ, right? I felt like Jesus was saying that, and he is too, you know, the scriptures speak to all of us. He's saying it to you and me. Who do you say I am? Okay, well, you're the Son of God. You're the Lord, the King of the universe. Well, then why are you not following what I told you to do? You know, like he said to the apostles, if they hear you, they hear me. If they reject you, they reject me. He gave the apostles the authority to forgive sins. So he sets up, like you can read it all in the gospel. And from this moment where I had like, felt like, you know, St. Paul with the scales fell off his eyes, I start seeing all this that I never seen before. I mean, I'd read the gospel before, you know, but I had never seen the foundation where, you know, thou art Peter, on this rock I'll build my church. Like, that's glaringly obvious. It's so obvious that like, that's the number one thing that like people attack, you know, that. And then when he breathed on the apostles and gave them the ability to forgive sins, he gave them the authority to go out and baptize all nations. And then the one that when they hear you, they hear me, when they reject you, they reject me. So he gives the apostles this authority. And it's, you know, the charter, you know, the charter is divine. Like he's instituted this institution and he's created it based on Peter. You know, the 12 apostles are the 12 foundation stones that Jesus says, and he'll set up 12 thrones to judge the nations. And in Revelation, John talks about the 12 stones that the city is built on, right, with the names inscribed on them. So then I said, well, if this is here, I'm in rebellion against this. So I have to, even though I don't necessarily agree with everything, but if this is the church that Christ founded, and Christ founded it and said the gates of hell will not prevail against it, and it's 2,000 years later, and it's still around, and still around in a recognizable form, like it's not like a shadow of what it was, or it's not like, you know, like they say, like this group over here is the Templars, and they went underground, and like, you know, like it's not like this conspiratorial, it's this visible church that's been there for 2,000 years. Yeah. Well, then I have to sign up.
It's like this big shift in the burden of proof, right?
Right.
It's like, it's no longer, why is the Catholic Church what she says she is? It's, well, what right do I have to be Protestant? Like, I have to know. I have to be real clear on why I'm not part of that church.
I went from trying to prove that the Catholic Church, that, you know, that was not the true church, to now I'm trying to figure out, do I have any kind of wiggle room here to not become Catholic?
Right.
I didn't want to become Catholic. I did not want to.
Right.
But I was so convicted by my conscience. And I knew that this was it, this was the truth. Everything was leading me to this. I said, I have to do it, you know? And I figured just in time, I really didn't know even what it entailed. I didn't know, I never had heard of RCIA. I didn't know what the process was.
Yeah.
I actually called the local parish and I was like, hi, I'm a Protestant. And they were like, okay, I don't want to be anymore. How do I change that? The lady on the phone was kind of, she thought it was a prank call probably, but she said, well, we have a, you know, she explained RCIA and said, come into the classes and stuff. I said, okay, well, put me down. You know, it's like the first Wednesday of the month. It was in the fall. So They said, it's starting up on Wednesdays. Come on down and we'll walk you through the process. I said, great. I signed up, but you know, didn't stop there.
Yeah.
So I called my mother. And I told her, and she said, oh, like, you know, that's wonderful. What did your father say? I never did. I had been having this, like, argument with myself, but I never really did, like, I'm a very kind of private person. Sure. So this whole thing is kind of alien to me.
Yeah.
But I never mentioned it to my father, like, not even in passing. Like, it was all, I was studying it, I was looking, I was reading it, I was doing all these things, but it was just me, you know? And I worked with my father. We were partners at the time. And so I called him up. And I told him, I'm going to become Catholic. And that did not go well.
Oh, wow.
And he told me that I was doing it just taking sides against the family, like Michael Corleone or Fredo.
Yeah.
And he told me I was taking sides. And he said, you're doing this just to hurt me. And like, but now this is a man that technically was Presbyterian. He said, I'm Presbyterian, you're Presbyterian, your grandfather was Presbyterian, all the way back, and trace it back to John Knox, I guess. But he was technically Presbyterian, I was technically Presbyterian. We hadn't been to a Presbyterian church in, at this point, probably 10 or 15 years. And he described himself as a Christian. He would just, you know, if you ask him, are you, and he was very devoutly, my father, very devoutly Christian, but just kind of like C.S. Lewis, mere Christianity Christian, like nothing. Didn't want to talk about doctrine, didn't want to talk about, like, if anyone brought anything up, he didn't want to, because I guess to him, he just didn't want to rock the boat. But to him, it was more of a family thing. It was like, it wasn't so much religiously he's Presbyterian, but his family's Presbyterian.
Right.
And so that's the way it is. So it was actually such a kind of a, as shocking as finding out the fathers were so Catholic, finding out my father was so against me becoming Catholic was like, and so I called up the parish and I canceled my meeting, you know, and just kind of called it off for the time being.
Yeah. Wow.
It was.
Wow. That's tough.
It was tough. Yeah.
Yeah. What happens next?
So that was early 2000s. And then I kind of, it gets backseated again. So the same way I got backseated when, you know, I was in my teen years. And, but at this point now I'm kind of like pseudo Catholic, you know? I said, well, I believe in the church now, and I guess I'll just read about it, and I'll read some of the early writings. I'll read some of the, and I would just, I almost exclusively, not exclusively, but almost exclusively started going to Mass at that point. Go to Mass every Sunday. And my father was fine. Yeah, actually, after this fight, like, okay, big fight, blow up, we make amends. The only other thing we ever fought with this bad was I wore a Boston jersey one time. He was a Yankees fan.
That's terrible.
That's the only other time he told me he took sides against the family. So the Red Sox and Catholics was the two. But actually, we went to Mass together a couple of times. Like, he was perfectly fine with me being Catholic.
Participating.
Yeah. Everything. Just not officially. Huh. Just because, I don't know. That was the bridge too far.
Right. You know?
So we continue on, you know, just he ends up getting cancer that went, you know, he had skin cancer for years, and it just kind of devolved into, got into his skull and into his brainstem, and we had to go to Texas for special treatments. And he called me the one day, just out of the blue, and he said, do you still believe all that Catholic stuff? And I said, yeah. And I said, you know, there's been no point in the last 10 years that I haven't. And he said, well, I'm sorry how I acted last time. I want you to become Catholic.
Wow.
Just like that.
Wow.
So he ended up passing away from the cancer. And I come back, you know, we were in Arizona at the time. We come back to Arizona from Texas. And I started RCIA.
What a beautiful moment of reconciliation. I mean, wow, yeah. Huh, well, okay, so RCIA again.
Yeah, that was, RCIA was like, I didn't want to do it. You know, I wanted to become Catholic.
Yeah.
But I, you know, always looking for the shortcut or looking for like the...
Married at this point yet?
This point, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I got married in between the no, you can't, and yes, you can.
Okay, so.
Right. And I mean, I didn't, you know, technically I didn't need his permission, you know, but I wanted his blessing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I got married in 07. So this was like 2014.
And she wasn't Catholic, right?
No, she wasn't Catholic. She's like non-denominational.
Okay.
You know, church every Sunday, reads her Bible, like religiously. Amen. Not just, well, technically everyone reads it religiously, but like my wife starts, you know, every morning reading her Bible.
Beautiful.
Yeah. So I didn't want to do RCIA at all. I wanted to kind of, it's like been 10 years on this road, you know, like, or it's 2014 now. It's been since I talked with my grandfather about, like, you know, John chapter 6, it's been maybe 15 years. So let's just cut to the chase. You know, what do I got to do? I got to stay. I didn't even know what the process was. I thought, you know, stand up in front of the congregation, renounce John Calvin and Martin Luther. Like, I don't know what the, I'm sorry, I hereby swear. So I go to this parish in Arizona, and I walk in and I said, like, I want to become Catholic. And she said, okay. It was late spring, early summer. And she said, the RCIA classes don't start until the fall. I said, well, I don't really want to do RCIA. And she said, well, that's how you become Catholic. I said, there has to be, you know, because I had read Rome Sweet Home, and I knew that Scott Hahn, I mean, I wasn't a pastor of a church, but I knew that there was exceptions. And she said, well, there's a couple of adult confirmation classes. Come to the adult confirmation classes and sit through them. A couple of weeks isn't going to kill you. You've waited, because I explained to her. She said, you've waited this long. It's been 15 years. A couple of weeks ain't going to kill you. I said, okay. And so I go to the couple of classes, and then we have like an interview and sit down. And she said, okay, like, ask me all kinds of questions. And she said, well, I'm pretty, you know, convinced. But at this point, I missed this, was in 04, when I initially wanted to convert, I was convinced of the authority of the church and the real presence, but really nothing else. Over the course of 10 years, I had become convinced of everything, right? And so when you stand in front of the congregation, you say, I believe and profess all of the Catholic Church teaches, preaches, and proclaims to be revealed by God. I couldn't have said that in 2004. Like, it wouldn't, I don't even know if I'd done the RCIA for 6 or 9 months, if I would have come to that point by Easter Vigil of 2005. I don't know, or six, I don't know if I could have done that. But now, you know, fast forward, I've spent 40 years in Sinai wandering around, you know, like, God brought the Hebrews out of Egypt, but then he had to take Egypt out of the Hebrews, you know? So I spent my time wandering the desert, and during that time I had been reading and reading and reading. I think I've read all of Scott Hahn's library. The one book that really was, and it wasn't so much for me, it was How to Talk to Family, was Born Fundamentalist, Born Again Catholic.
Right.
That was
Curry,
game changer, really. That just completely like lit a fire under me to like really get this, you know, get this going. Because after that conversation with Dad and I got back to Arizona, I was kind of like, well, I guess I could continue as this kind of pseudo-Catholic, you know, then I wouldn't have to go to confession. I can go to Mass and just sit there during communion. And then, so I thought I could continue the way I was, but I read that book and it lit a fire under me.
Yeah, you know, you make me think about, I mean, our divisions in Christianity are really, they really are a wound, right? Because we see that families, there's this desire amongst family to worship together, to be in communion, right? And so that, you know, your father, even this having this real deep identity with his Presbyterianism, even though he wasn't practicing, right? And so figuring out how to talk about it well and be patient with people is just, you know, it's just so important because God works, as you have talked about, you know, in his time and his providence, you know, the many years in Sinai, you know, or in the desert.
And usually with a sense of humor too.
Exactly.
Things come back around, and like I look at them from, you know, removed from time, like back.
Yeah.
And laugh, like things that like at the time I didn't like at all.
Yeah.
And now it's like, oh yeah, that was funny, you know.
Yeah.
But
you worked through the Mary stuff in that time. Talk about that a little bit.
Yeah. Well, the Mary stuff, I didn't. I was like, well, they pray to Mary and they, you know, the rosary and all this stuff. I wasn't so much like opposed to it. It just felt strange,
right?
You know, but then I said, okay, I'm going to, during that time in the desert, I said, I'm going to systematically go through each, I've got all the time in the world. I'm going to go through each doctrine and see where it leads me. And, you know, I started out with the virgin birth. I was like, well, check, you know, that's easy. And then I went on to the perpetual virginity of Mary, and the perpetual virginity, you know, it hinges on that. Joseph never had relations with her until Christ, Jesus was born, until the child was born, until, everyone hinges on that word until, but, you know, if I tell you don't do anything until I get there, it doesn't mean once I get there, I want you to do whatever it was I was telling you not to do. It just means like, wait till I get there.
Yeah.
So that word doesn't mean like necessary. And then I started reading some of the Protestant reformers like Calvin, Luther, and Zwingli. They all thought that Mary was perpetually a virgin. And then it just made sense, you know, if she's the spouse of the Holy Spirit and she gave birth, you know, the, I can't remember who it was that said it, said that if the land that Christ walked on was holy, imagine what the womb he dwelt in.
Yeah.
You know, so would it be completely against Christ's nature for Mary to have other, no, but like, it's also like the Immaculate Conception. Did Mary need to be immaculately conceived so that Christ could be the Savior of the world? No, God's, you know, God could have done anything.
Right.
God didn't have to come as a baby. Jesus didn't have to be born as a baby. He could have been like, just appeared as a fully grown man. But he was born as a defenseless child. Well, I mean, first off, in the womb of a mother, you know, of a people that were oppressed in a backwater province of the mightiest empire in the world, and then born in a little, you know, so Judea is a backwater province. Bethlehem is like, you know, the boondocks of Judea, born to a 15, 14-year-old girl who is betrothed to this man who's just a day laborer. Like, none of it was glorious. It was really like Christ emptied himself, you know, and came down, just like Paul says. Like, he really did come down to the lowest of the low, 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 low to show us, you know, like, this is like, he's here for us. And so the Immaculate Conception, did that need to happen? No, it wasn't necessary, but it's really, it's good that he done it because, you know, it's proper. If God can preserve someone from sin, why wouldn't he preserve his mother? Yeah. You know, so then, like you said, the burden of proof, it gets flipped around.
Yeah.
Well, why wouldn't God do that?
Yeah.
And nobody really has an answer. Well, because he didn't, because all men have sinned. Well, Jesus was a man. Did Jesus sin? Like the,
yeah.
That doesn't, so it obviously all men have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God doesn't mean Jesus. So why can't it not mean Mary too? And then, you know, you get into the full of grace, and if you're full of grace, there's no room for anything else. So I worked my way through the Marian doctrines, and I think it wasn't so much that I didn't believe them, it was that I didn't really understand them. But once I understood what they meant, and like the assumption of Mary, you know, that she didn't ascend to heaven, she was assumed to heaven. It wasn't by her power, she was drawn up by God. So like once you understand the Catholic teaching of it, the caricature of what you think is the Catholic teaching of things doesn't match what reality a lot of times.
Right.
And so really, for me, getting through the issues wasn't so much convincing, like finding a convincing argument, it was just learning the argument.
Yeah.
And once I learned the Catholic argument, I was like, oh, it makes perfect sense.
Well, you make a great point too, like going through the different aspects of the incarnation. It's always funny that there are certain aspects of this fairy tale story. And I don't mean that it's not true. I mean that it's to some degree it's arbitrary, right? God could have done it this way, he could have done it that way. The question for the Christian or for the truth seeker is, how did God do it?
Right.
I want to know, right? And so sometimes there's a acceptance of this part of the story, but then there's a reluctance to accept this part. And the question is, why aren't we curious to, I want to know the whole thing. And so with some of these doctrines, is it possible that it could be true? Like, is there any logically or theological reason why this could not be the case? And most of the things, there aren't those reasons. So then it's just a question of, okay, so what is the truth?
Right.
What's the history there? What really happened?
And where do we go for that? And a lot of people's counter arguments to it is they just don't want to believe it.
Right.
It's just like, well, that isn't how I was raised. Well, it doesn't matter how you were raised at this point. It's,
right.
You know, what's the truth? You got to drill down to what the truth is.
Yeah.
And like I said, God didn't have to conceive Mary immaculately. He didn't have to assume her into heaven. It's proper that he did. I mean, she's his mother and she's laying there. And it says, what is it in Psalms? I won't let my righteous ones corrupt, you know? Right. So he assumed her body into heaven. And even like just historically, there's never been a place in the world that claims to have the bones of the Blessed Mother.
Right.
You know, even just on a historical level, that's a pretty compelling argument to me. Because if someone had the bones of the Blessed Mother, that's a pretty good like relic. I mean, like the Venetians went to Egypt and stole the bones of St. Mark because they knew that would give them some gravitas, you know? So someone would have definitely tried to steal Mary at some point.
Right.
But nobody's ever, there's never been a claim to her body.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that kind of points to that too. But yeah, the getting through the Marian doctrines or papal infallibility or the indefectibility of the church, any of these doctrines, for me, was more of studying what they actually, like, it wasn't so much like a hurdle that I had to clear, like I just couldn't accept it. The authority and the real presence was the only ones I couldn't accept. And once I accepted them, everything else was more just learning what the doctrine was.
Sure.
And then I'd learn it, I'd be like, all right, check. And then on to the next one, check.
And learning it from the source, too.
From the source, right. Too, yeah. I mean, you can't...
I've said those chick tracks, you know.
Right, right. If I want to know what a Baptist believes, I'll read a Baptist book about a Baptist. It's not... I don't think it's fair to read, like, an apologetics book. Like, if I'm going to read a book that a Lutheran wrote about a Mormon, I don't think that's fair. I'll read what a Mormon wrote about Mormonism, you know? So you got to go to the source. And so I bought a catechism. Never had heard of a catechism before. I bought a catechism and I would read through it. I was like, oh, this is amazing. They put everything they believed down in writing. Because a lot of the mega churches I had gone to didn't have a statement of faith, like none at all. And I remembered going to Catholic school as a child, like as a young child, because the school that I went to closed down when I was in like third grade. I ended up going to public school. But they'd say the creed during Mass. Right. They taught us the creed in classes. Even the Presbyterian church I went to, they would say the Apostles' Creed every Sunday. So like, this is what we believe. We believe this, this, this. And it's like, you know, this is what we believe. The mega churches didn't have that. And a lot of people, like, you could talk to them, well, what do you believe? And like, there was a variance of belief,
right. Not
just among different denominations, but inside of a single church, there's this wide variance of belief. In Catholicism, there's this book, it's about that thick, and this is what we believe, you know, and just read it's black and white.
Yeah.
Pretty easy.
Yeah, it's this shift in, again, this shift in relationship to the truth. Am I trying to find things that confirm my feelings and my belief? Or am I trying to turn outward and look for, you know, what's the truth out there?
Right.
It's a different attitude towards truth.
Yeah. Right? You got to take yourself out of it, too. And over them 10 years, I completely, it broke me down that I was completely out of it. It wasn't no more I was going to find the truth because I'm a truth seeker. You know, I'm like the Indiana Jones of truth. I'm going to go out and I'm going to discover. Now it's just like, I don't know the truth.
Yeah.
Show me the truth. You know?
We got about 5 minutes left. So you bring us home and talk about what happened after that. So you entered the church. Tell us about the...
Yeah, well, I went through the RCIA process. Like I said, I tried avoiding it, and they tried to get me a waiver and everything, but the pastor had an emergency, and he resigned because of a health emergency. Then another one came in, and we had like temporary pastors until finally Father Robert got installed. And by that point, surprising to me, God's got a sense of humor. I was enjoying RCIA. So I said, no, I don't want a waiver. I want to continue the process. And went through, and I received Easter Vigil 2016. And when I stood up and I said, you know, I believe and profess, I really did believe all that the church teaches and proclaims. And like I said, without that 10 years of wandering, I wouldn't have been able to say that, honestly.
That's beautiful. All right. Well, so since, just bring us up to speed now, since then you're working construction.
Yeah. Still working construction. I wrote a book about the Mass. So, some of my family members and stuff, cause they said that I could explain things well to them, you know, like different parts of the Mass and the meaning, the deep theological meanings. Cause you know, you go to Mass and it's 45 minutes to an hour.
Right.
And some people just go through it and then they don't really understand all the symbolic meanings of all the different things. So I wrote a book to try to walk through that, to try to help people appreciate it better.
What's the name of that?
As the Beauty of the Mass.
Beauty of the Mass. Yep. Awesome. All right. Well, so we have about 4 minutes left. If you would talk again, I asked a couple times early on in the journey about, you know, your relationship with Christ and prayer, you know, and at that point early on in the journey, you mentioned that it had become more of an intellectual exercise, this riddle to solve. Talk about, you know, again, how, especially becoming Catholic, what that, you know, what have you discovered in terms of prayer, of the sacraments, right, your relationship with God?
I wasn't really praying. Like during the early parts of the journey, it was just, like I said, it was a pursuit. It was more like intellectual than it was spiritual completely. At some point I started praying, and it was around the time my father passed away. I really, you know, started praying a lot then, but even then it was different. You know, it was kind of like, it wasn't there's perfect contrition is where you're sorry because you offended God, you know, where imperfect is where you're sorry just because you got caught, basically. And so it was at some point during RCIA that they walked us through the Divine Mercy Chaplet, how to pray that and stuff. And I just had this kind of change. I really can't point to exactly where it happened, but there was this change in my way of talking to God, to where it was no longer just, God, forgive me for my sins because I don't want to go to hell, to, I'm sorry that I offended you. You know, because God's all perfect, all loving. And when we sin, we're falling short of that perfection that God called us to. Be perfect as I am perfect. It's impossible, but with his grace, you know, all things are possible. So it became this more of a relationship. And I laughed when it happened because, you know, Protestants talk all the time about this personal relationship, and Catholics have religion, but not relationship. I have a relationship with Christ now that I never had before, where I feel like, you know, I can talk to him. God is my father, you know? And it's just this whole, really, there's no other word for it, but relationship that I never had before.
Yeah.
Before it was just church, Bible, like it was kind of like this like system, you know?
Yeah, that really is in the end what it's about. And it is funny, the irony of how that language works, you know, but all, I mean, the ultimate relationship is really the sacraments. Catholics get accused of having all this stuff, you know, all these works, you know, but the sacraments are this ultimate thing where we're not doing it. It's not us.
We're receiving.
God is condescending and giving himself to us, you know?
Yeah. We don't take communion. We receive communion.
Right.
And there's nothing like, there's the old medieval imagery of the pelican that's pecking at its own breast.
Right.
And I see that, you know, my father's mother, that's her family crest. And I'd seen it all the time. I didn't know what it meant. It was just a bird that looks like it's feeding its babies. But that was a medieval image of Christ, you know, that he feeds us from himself. And how much more of a relationship do you want that Jesus gives you his body and blood? Like he said, my blood is true drink and my flesh is true food. That's as close as you can be. That's as intimate of a relationship as could possibly be.
Absolutely.
On this side of the veil.
Yeah. You know? Yeah. Oh, that's beautiful. And again, that's what we're doing. That's why this is important. It isn't just that intellectual exercise. It's not just the riddles. It's that, you know, the proposal here is that not through anything we've done, but we have this great gift in the church. We have the great gift of the sacraments, what God has given to us. It's not you know, religion shouldn't be man's search for God. It's God coming to meet man, you know, and that's what we have in the Catholic Church, really blessed by it. So, hey, thanks so much, Charlie, for sharing your story with us tonight.
Really appreciate it.
And thank you for being here for this episode of the Journey Home program. I pray that Charlie's story was an inspiration and encouragement to you. Again, if you're on a journey, you know, like Charlie, so, you know, from a background like he has come from, Presbyterian or non-Catholic Christian, or even outside Christianity, if the Lord has touched your heart and you're wanting to seek out the truth and come to know Jesus Christ, we want to walk with you. We want to pray for you. So reach out to us at chnetwork.org. We'd like to pray for you on that journey and walk with you. So again, thanks for joining us for this episode of the Journey Home program. God bless you. We'll talk to you again next week.